On The Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is The Murder Squad. A 36-year-old former Marine joins the Army to start a new life. But the new life isn't what she had hoped. While at Fort Hood, she becomes addicted to drugs. Trying to overcome her addiction, she goes home to her family in North Carolina, then decides to return to her friend in Killeen, Texas.
A friend lends her a home to stay in. Her addiction becomes present again. When her mother doesn't hear from her for several days, she checks the local Killeen newspaper. The headline says a 36-year-old woman's death is being investigated as a homicide. The mother is met with misinformation and very little help from the police department. And now, 10 years later, her daughter's death remains unsolved. Our job? To find the killer of Candace Bowley.
This is The Murder Squad.
So, Billy, I'm still trying to get used to seeing you in glasses. Are you ever going to try contacts?
Okay. I have contacts.
Yeah.
I have worn contacts since I believe I was 12 years old. And these glasses are old man glasses because these are reading glasses.
Well, I've got plenty of reading glasses.
Yeah. So that's what these are for.
No, I get
it. But thank you for bringing up the one thing that has depressed me more than most things when it comes to aging.
It's tough. Yeah. No, eyesight is huge. You know, I told everybody, you know, I went to contacts and I'm loving them. You know, there's certain limitations, but I've actually gotten to be a pro at putting them in and pretty much taking them out. So I'm very happy with where I'm at right
fantastic.
Now.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Yes. Do you still need a mirror? Can you put them on without the mirror?
I can, but I generally will try to use one of those magnifying mirrors, you know, least I don't have any bleeding going on after I put them in or take them out. So it's good.
Good. All right. You could save the bleeding eyes for your next distraction. But, so we do have, an update. Rodney Alcala, the dating game killer, has died. Now, if you remember in the Can I Take Your Picture four-parter season two, we covered him in episodes 1, 3, 5, and 6. He was one of the photographer serial killers. When he was caught, he had a lot of photographs of other women that he may or may not have murdered that we needed to ID. So he died in prison on July 24th, exactly 42 years after he was captured. You know, he actually won the date on the dating game show, but never went on the date because the woman thought he was creepy.
Right. Right.
You know, she nailed that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, you know, it's an interesting aspect because when she didn't see him and she hadn't been in his physical presence, his charm is what won her over. But backstage, the woman's intuition took over and she's like, oh, no. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that is an interesting thing. I would like everybody to do that because I don't know if you're watching it. It's creepy because we're watching him and listening to his answers when he calls. When I think she asks him, what kind of fruit would you be? And he says a banana. And then he says, like, what's the best time? And he says nighttime. It looks creepy as hell. But maybe if you turn off the visuals, maybe it doesn't. But
right.
Who knows? But, you know, we know that this guy killed 8 people. Robin Samso, Jill Barkham, Georgia Wickstead, Charlotte Lamb, Jill Parenteau, Christine Thornton, Cornelia Crilly, Ellen Halver. But when he was arrested in 79, there were those hundreds of pictures that had unidentified women in them, and we're still looking to ID them. So we'd like to have another push to ID those victims because Alcala just completely clammed up when it came down to it.
Yeah. You know, and that's, you know, of course I have, you know, no sympathy or empathy for Alcala having, you know, died. And I hope, you know, he suffered during the course of his final moments, but at the same time, it pains me that he took secrets with him. you know, yeah. And it would sure be nice to have had, you know, at least somebody have another shot at him to see, you know, who else did he kill? Who else did he victimize?
Yeah. So, like we said, you know, take a look at the photos that are out there. We've published some because we didn't, you know, we wanted to concentrate on five or six, but there's a lot of others that are out there. If you happen to notice one, and we know that these are from a long time ago, you might be a listener who was around back then. But these are the kind of things that share it with your friends and family. And just ask them, hey, do you recognize this person? Yeah. That's the best way it's going to be done. So, but for now, we're going to go to Killeen, Texas. 36-year-old Candance Boley had always wanted to be a Marine, just like her dad and her grandfather. When she graduated high school, that's exactly what she did. She was a legal specialist while serving her 4 years. The Marine Corps took her to many different places, including Okinawa, Japan. After she was honorably discharged, she moved to Oceanside, California with her then boyfriend. There she worked as a paralegal until she met a different man. Candance then relocated to Indianapolis and worked for a title company and had her first child. Things were going well until the market crashed, the housing market, in 2006. She lost her job. By 2007, she wanted a fresh start and she decided to go back to her first love, which was the military, but this time she joined the Army. And eventually she'd be stationed at Fort Hood in Texas. Now, while at Fort Hood, Candance became involved in the drug world, and she started to habitually use crack cocaine. The Army sent her to rehab, but Candance still struggled with her addiction. And by the end of 2010, she was discharged from the Army. After being discharged, she went to be with her parents on the East Coast for a little while. But she told her mom that she missed her friends and wanted to return back to Killeen, Texas. Her mother, Terry, didn't want her to go back, but, you know, she was an adult. Terry told us about Candance's return and her time in the Army.
She went AWOL I don't know how many times. And then ultimately she was kicked out of the Army and decided, you know, after a few months, she came and visited us for a few months and then decided to go back there. And that was near the end of 2010. So she went back there and she met some guy who owned a house, you know, on the not so good side of town, but he wasn't staying there. He was taking care of his dad, but he offered her to stay in his house. So she did that. Well, long story short, from the time he met her until her death, he was obsessed with her.
Terry stayed in contact with Candance every few days while she was back in Texas. Around July 4, 2011, most of the communication was through email or Facebook. Candance's phone was no longer working, but she never went longer than a day or two without reaching out on Facebook or some other digital form to her family. During this time, Candance had been living at a friend's home. The man was very romantically interested in her and had offered her the home since it meant that Candance wouldn't need to couch surf anymore. The house was on Palmer Avenue. On July 12th, Terry hadn't heard from her daughter for a couple of days. She became worried. She tried reaching out, but there was no answer. She decided to check the local paper in Killeen. On the front page was an article about an unnamed 36-year-old woman murdered on Palmer Avenue. The headline in the Killeen Daily Herald read, "Police treating woman's death as a homicide." Terry's husband called the police and had to leave a message. A few hours later, the Killeen victim's advocate called Terry.
Well, we were concerned because normally, you know, her normal morning would be to send me an email or send me a voice message or something. But we hadn't heard from her for a few days. So I got really concerned. It was on a Monday or a Tuesday. I pulled up the Killeen Daily newspaper and saw the article, front page, about a 36-year-old woman that was found dead in her home. And it was on Palmer Avenue or Palmer Lane. And that's all it really said. And they were treating it as a homicide. And I was like, oh my gosh, she lived on Palmer. I knew that because I sent her a Christmas present And I said, I know she lived on that street, and I couldn't remember what the address number was or anything. So I had my husband call the police department, the Killeen Police Department. Probably about an hour later, I get a call from the Killeen Police Department on my cell phone. And that's how we found out. It wasn't the detective who called me. It was the victim's advocate and one of the, a sergeant on the police force. So I thought that was kind of odd. So she gave me the name of the detective, which was Carlos Ortiz, and his number to call. So we called him for 5 days straight. He never called us back, never took a phone call.
The Killeen Police Department reported that Candence had been shot. According to Terry, this was to protect the integrity of the case.
When I talked to the two women, they had said that they're telling the public Candy was shot because the streets talk. People will talk. And they'll find out who did it really quick. And I was like, okay. So when I talked to Ortiz, he says, I don't want you on social media. I don't want you talking to anybody. And I don't want you telling anybody how she died. Because if you do, I will have you arrested for hindering or obstructing a murder case. And I was like, can you do that?
So, Paul, what about this? And in your neck of the woods, did any of the agencies that you worked for ever do this?
Okay, well, I understand. I think maybe the best way to say it is the spirit of what the investigating agency is trying to do here. You know, there is definitely a very robust rumor mill out on the streets that can cause problems if actual information as to what happened gets out there. However, by seeding false information, this causes a whole other set of problems with that same rumor mill, as well as possibly with, trying to prosecute the case down the road. Right. You know, this is where it's better, and this is, we all get frustrated on cases in which law enforcement doesn't divulge certain details. And this is where this is probably the better route to go, is be accurate with the information. Because if somebody out there hears something that's accurate, you might get an accurate lead coming back versus a false lead. Mm-hmm. But if you have information that only the killer would know, and you're concerned about false confessions, or you're concerned about other aspects that could taint tips coming in, then you can hold back those select details to benefit the investigation. That's the best way to go. So actually putting out something that is so blatantly wrong is just going to snowball this investigation down the wrong path.
Yeah. So Terry provided us with the autopsy, and we're going to go through it. But when Candence was discovered by a friend on the evening of July 11th, she was wearing a green short sleeve shirt, black bra, blue jeans, and a black belt. Her hair was pulled back with a brown headband, and according to the autopsy report, she was discovered face down on her bedroom floor. Her body was in the early stages of decomposition. There were multiple blunt force trauma injuries to the skull, neck, trunk, and extremities, including contusions to her brain, broken fingers, and lacerations to her head and body. The medical examiner noted signs of strangulation, specifically an abraded furrow across the front of her neck and fractured thyroid cartilage. What is not mentioned once in the autopsy is a gunshot or a bullet found. The conclusion of the medical examiner was that the manner of death was homicide, and the cause of death was blunt force head injuries associated with strangulation. We also know a sexual assault test was conducted, but we don't have those results. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But we do have this autopsy. Paul, you've taken a look at it. Anything jump out at you?
Well, of course, you know, the blunt force trauma is extensive to her face, to her head. It has severe lacerations. Some of these lacerations have 6 inches in length, and the pathologist describes these lacerations as full thickness, meaning that the entire depth of the skin tissue was split as a result of the blow. And with several of the lacerations, there's broken bone, which is skull, underneath. So these are significant blows that are being inflicted. And the length of that laceration, and there's no indication, I haven't seen photos, but there's no indication that the pathologist is saying that there's overlapping lacerations, tends to suggest you're dealing probably with a broader type of weapon. Now, there are some shorter lacerations that are on her face and skull. She is being severely beaten, and the weapon that is used could have either been a stomping. There probably could be blows with a fist, or you could have had some other broad type weapon. There's nothing to indicate that it was a narrower weapon that, or something that is leaving a distinctive injury, such as a hammer or crowbar.
A crowbar, something like that.
Yes. Now, the other important thing is that the pathologist is noting bruising as well as lacerations on her arms, her hands, etc., defensive injuries. She is aware that she's being beaten. She's alive at the time that she is receiving these blows. And then, of course, there's the abraded furrow across the front of her neck with the fractured thyroid cartilage. This is entirely consistent. It appears that there was minimally at least a ligature strangulation. And as we know from previous cases that we've discussed, depending on what else is present, you know, is it possible that there is a form of manual strangulation that was layered with the injury of the ligature?
Right. So as far as what might have been taken from the scene, Terry was able to get a list of items that were taken from the home. It was a Samsung phone, a notebook that was on the table, a black purse containing a wallet and papers, 3 brass tubes, 2 hard drives, a wooden plaque, a razor knife, and a hot water faucet handle. And discovered at the scene was also a broken and bloody necklace. And you could see at the bottom of the report that there was a cigarette butt found on her front knee. That's how they word it. Cigarette butt on left knee. That they would have taken. Now that is, there's a lot of things there. Terry says that the plaque was the murder weapon, and that it had some sort of barometer on it, like a plaque that had a that kind of thing. I remember right. My family had one when I was in the '70s. That was a thing to do. But taking a look at this list. Is anything jumping out at you? I mean, I thought that the cigarette butt being on her, you know, having them saying it's on her knee after a vicious assault, you know, the killer had to have left that butt there. That's what I'm thinking, but who knows?
Well, you know, it is possible. Now, you know, based on the early information that we got on this case, you know, she's found face down. And so they're describing the cigarette butt being collected from the front knee of Candace's jeans. So this sounds like to me, this was a cigarette butt that, adhered to her jeans when they turned her over, which is what we would commonly do. You know, we have a victim that's face down, we'll turn them over so we can see the front side of the victim, document the front side of the victim, and look for evidence. Now, is this a butt from the killer? It could be. Is this a butt that was present on the floor? And then during the homicide, she comes to rest on top of it, and now it's sticking to the front of her knee. You know, that's the million-dollar question, but you have to go after it from an evidence standpoint. In case it is from the killer. You know, what a little bit that stands out to me is, you know, the 3 brass tubes and the razor knife. you know, again, without seeing photos of these items and just based on those descriptions, the brass tubes and the razor knife sound like drug paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. So now, you know, are we dealing with a house in which we have the drug users that are present? And is this a house in which, you know, we would refer to either as a flop house or even a crack house, you know, depending on the era that we're talking about? At the time, the man who allowed Candace to live at his home was doing his best to investigate the case, just like Terry. The police weren't extremely helpful in relaying information. The man who owned the house knew Candace often went to the neighborhood Texaco station. He visited the station after her murder to see if she'd been there. She had, on July 9th. It was also the last day anyone had heard from Candace. In the video, she was wearing the same clothes her body was discovered in. And she was with a soldier.
They have a copy of it with this man in the Army at a Texaco gas station. They went inside the gas station. So you have a clear picture of him, but it doesn't show her, but they have the video.
Police were able to identify the soldier. He hasn't been named, so we aren't going to here. But the lead seemed to go nowhere.
Paul, what about this soldier that she was with before that night, in the same clothes? How hard are you going to look at that guy?
He's like almost the first person you need to be talking to. You know, minimally, he may be the last person who saw Candace alive. So I want to know what was going on. Why were they together? What were they doing? Where did they go? When, if he's claiming he left her alive, when did that happen? You know, what did he do afterwards? If I start hinking up and thinking this guy is potentially the killer, I've got video of him being with her the night that she likely was killed, or the day she likely was killed, and she's in the same clothes her body's found in. He's got to be considered as possibly the offender in the case. His DNA is found in the crime scene. You know, at this point, we don't know, well, what is the source of that DNA? Where in the crime scene is it? But he is somebody that absolutely has to be interviewed. His statements need to be memorialized. And if there is anything in the investigation, in the evidence down the road that contradicts what he said happened, then now he rockets up to becoming a primary suspect. And in 2012, the original detective on the case retired and began working for the DA's office. The new detective didn't reach out much to Terry either. In 2017, Terry reached out to him. There had been an arrest in Killeen the year after Candace's murder. But Terry hadn't heard of the man until several years later, when his DNA was linked to cases in Fayetteville, North Carolina, near where she lived. The man's name was William Razor.
Now, on May 25th of 2012, William Razor approached a sex worker in Killeen. After the two had sex, Razor then knocked the woman unconscious. She came to laying face down and bleeding. Razor had taken her purse, her shoes, and her money. Just 3 days later, Razor approached a different woman. He offered her a ride and she accepted. Again, he paid the woman for sex. Razor couldn't perform and he demanded his money back. The woman refused. He began beating her in the face. Then he stole her money and left. The first case had DNA in a rape kit that matched Razor's. The second victim was able to identify him. His DNA was also found on the condom at the scene. He was convicted of both of these crimes and sentenced to 18 years. And then his DNA was placed in the national database. In July of 2015, his DNA was matched to other crimes. One in June of 2005 in Fayetteville, North Carolina, he had tried to force himself on a woman. She said no. He punched her repeatedly. Then he raped her. Almost 2 years later, on February 16, 2007, 39-year-old April Kemp was beaten to death in the parking area of the Red Carpet Inn. Her cause of death? Blunt force trauma to the head. A blood trail from the body led to one of the rooms. Inside was more blood and a used condom. The DNA again matched Razor. Razor assaulted another woman in Fayetteville. On December 2nd, 2009, again at the red carpet, Razor raped the woman and held her captive in the room. In November 2018, Razor made a plea deal for his crimes in North Carolina. He pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 18 to 22 years. The sentence will be served after his Texas sentence is finished. Now, Paul, we're going to talk more about Razor and any similarities you see in a moment. But before that, this is what Terry told us when she discovered Razor.
So I was reading an article in the Fayetteville paper online, and all of a sudden I get a pop-up that says, if you like this story, you'll like this one. And I go, oh, okay. So I click on it, and it's about a man who was arrested in Texas, but through DNA, they found out he had murdered a woman in Fayetteville. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Let me read that. Well, what do you know? He was arrested in Killeen, Texas. And the arresting detective was the detective on Candy's case, the second detective. The first one retired and got a job at the DA's office as an investigator. You know, I hadn't been involved for a few years. I just like, you know, it's a really hard, it's difficult at the beginning to deal with any of this. You know, you just want to, you don't want to deal with it. So when I read that article, I knew this was the guy who killed her because he was there at that time. He was living in Killeen. He had several arrests in Killeen during that time period. And the girl he murdered in North Carolina was murdered basically, except for, you know, all the other stuff. But she was, it was blunt force trauma and strangulation for her, too.
So here's what we know about this crime scene. And we're going back to Candance's house. There were 13 DNA profiles present at the crime scene. One of them was William Razor's. Also present was the soldiers, the man who found her, and the owner of the home. So his DNA was identified as being in the home. We don't know where it was, but he certainly sounds good for this.
Yeah. You know, this is that wait, what moment when I'm hearing about William Razor and his criminal history. This guy is a bona fide serial predator. He is obviously a John with anger management issues. However, it's more than that. He is attacking women and he is violently assaulting them over and over again. And his DNA is found inside Candance's crime scene. And the way that Razor was assaulting the women that lived his attacks or survived his attacks, as well as the women that he killed, is identical to what happened to Candance. This is what I call a clue. And this is where, okay, so now you have a bona fide serial predator whose DNA is present inside Candace's crime scene. Has he been talked to? What kind of statements did he make? You know, has there been further efforts to find more evidence to be able to say, yes, we have evidence that shows that Razor is the offender in Candace's case? What is this association with this residence where Candace was killed? You know, what is the excuse that he's given for his DNA being present at this crime scene? You know, I've got so many questions about this particular suspect, and considering his criminal history, you know, he immediately rockets to the top of somebody I'm going to go after. Now, we also know that we have DNA from other individuals, and this is where I am wondering about, okay, what is going on inside this house? You know, there's 13 different DNA profiles at the crime scene, and they've identified the soldiers, the man who found her, the owner of the home. Is this just contact DNA from casual, you know, living through the house or passing through the house? Or do we have semen evidence here? Do we have drug paraphernalia that has different individuals' DNA on it, etc.? So, you know, so many questions. But right now, you have DNA from a serial predator.
Yeah. So even with Razor's DNA present inside Candace's home, the investigator at the time didn't think he was the offender. But through this detective, Terry was reminded that a rape kit was conducted on her daughter's body. And she asked what those results were because they weren't included in the lab results that she had been given. And this is what she said she was told.
And I said, well, why wouldn't one be done? And he goes, well, probably because of her profession. And I said, well, wait a minute. Was Candace ever arrested for prostitution or, you know, anything to do with sex? And he said, no. And I said, well, how could a detective make that assumption if you don't know? She was never arrested for any prostitution or anything like that.
Now, Paul.
Yeah.
Not testing the rape kit.
Right. Now, you know, I know Billy and I, we sometimes are not necessarily on other sides of the fence, but I do have a tendency to understand the challenges that law enforcement is confronted with and will sometimes err on giving them an out. But here I can't. By not testing the rape kit and what I like to call sexual assault kit, because there's so much more that is collected than just evidence of rape inside these kits. This is sheer negligence. And I don't care about the victimology. I don't care that they're thinking, oh, there's likely going to be DNA evidence from other consensual partners. You have to identify that evidence. Why are women killed? They're often killed because of who they're having sex with. You need to know that through the DNA evidence. Is the killer's DNA inside that sex kit? Absolutely. And then I go back to this Razor guy. You know, in his cases, at least in one of the cases, they found his DNA from the sexual assault kit, one of his victims. We have his DNA inside this crime scene. What if his DNA is on Candace's vaginal swab, her rectal swab, her oral swab, or on a body swab, or on her clothing, or in her underwear? I mean, that's now putting him in intimate contact with the victim. And considering his criminal history, to me, that's now probable cause for arrest.
I mean, one of the things from his other crime scenes is that there were condoms present from those other crime scenes. And first of all, not testing the rape kit is indefensible, but I was thinking maybe he was just like, well, you know, the guy might have worn a condom, but that wasn't going, it wasn't going to fit his narrative because he was still, for some reason, saying this guy wasn't the guy when they found his DNA somewhere. And whether or not they could have pinned it on him, like you said, first go talk to the guy. But also, while you're talking to the guy, test the rape kit.
Yeah.
Just to make it, you know, to make it that much. Make the case that much better. Sorry.
In this type of case, it's absolutely mandatory evidence.
Yeah.
What else can you get from a rape kit beyond semen? Like, what else is it telling you beyond sexual assault?
Out of my jurisdiction and generally across California, we don't refer to these rape kits as rape kits. And in part, that's because in California, we discreetly break down the different types of sex acts into their own crime categories, such as rape, you know, which is penetration, vaginal penetration. We've got sodomy, we've got oral copulation, digital penetration, foreign object penetration. Other jurisdictions kind of lump, you know, the sex acts under the rape category. But for me, when I see when I refer to this as a sexual assault evidence kit, it's more than just rape. It's these other sex acts, but it's also looking for associative evidence that is showing intimate contact between the offender and the victim. This is DNA evidence that may be attributed to sexual acts. It's DNA evidence that could be attributed to violence. Let's say the offender and the victim are in combat. And now the offender is got a bloody nose and he ends up passing some of his blood onto an area of the victim's body. His hair is being transferred. Other trace evidence. Maybe he's got a pet dog at home, and now his pet dog's hair is being transferred onto or into the victim's body. There is so much potential evidence, and it's so significant because this type of evidence is usually showing physical contact between two individuals when it's found inside these sex kits. And that is where it's so critical to go after this type of evidence, because you could have somebody saying, well, I was at that house before. But then why is your DNA on the victim or inside the victim or on her clothing? You know, it is absolutely critical in any case like this that the sexual assault kits be analyzed, that victimology be damned.
So Terry has had one other detective on her daughter's case, Detective Fisher. He's actually the reason Terry reached out to the murder squad, because he recently was reassigned to the evidence and crime lab department. But he encouraged her to continue to try and make noise. And he thought we were the right fit. This is what Terry had to say about him.
Well, now, today, we are without a detective. We have nobody dedicated to her case. The person that was working with us, Sergeant Fisher, who was, he's probably a godsend, and probably the only honest person I've ever had to deal with at that department, has been transferred all of a sudden to evidence.
Despite not having a detective on the case, Terry has been able to meet with the district attorney about Candance's case. Just last month they met. It was during that meeting she was told the rape kit was finally going to be tested, although she was told not to get her hopes up. The DA also shared with her that they have an eyewitness, but the timing seems off to Terry. According to her, the last time anyone saw or spoke to Candance was on July 9th, 2011. She was also told, based on the autopsy, Candance probably died on the 9th. However, this new eyewitness says he saw her alive and well the day her body was discovered. This is what Terry told us about the new information.
She says, well, you know, there's an eyewitness. And I was like, what? My husband and I look at each other and go, what the fuck? There's an eyewitness. Spencer, the guy who found her, who's also a crackhead, found her on the 11th. And he said he was smoking crack with her the morning of the 11th. And she shooed them away, made them go away. But he had left his backpack and then came back there. He saw a white two-tone truck in front of her house, and there was a guy there who was wrapped in a bed sheet or a blanket, who wouldn't let him in the house but handed him his backpack through a crack in the door. So Spencer saw the guy. And I was like, what, you know, where is this coming from? It's been 10 years and this is the first we're hearing of this, really? Okay, so Spencer knows this guy or has seen him. And I'm like, okay, but you look at the autopsy report and you tell me if she died that day. There's no way. I had a doctor look at it. I had a retired detective look at it. And they're saying the same thing. She died at least 2 days before. She died on the 9th, sometime on the 9th or early on the 10th. She was not alive the whole day of the 10th or the whole day of the 11th. She was dead. So if Spencer is claiming that he was there, and like I told Sergeant Fisher, if he's claiming he was there smoking crack with her on the 11th, he was smoking with a corpse.
Now, just quickly, I will tell you, Spencer, the guy who found her, was a habitual drug user who used drug with Candace on a regular basis. So he may have no sense of time or what day it was or anything else. Supposedly, the person that met him at the door that he talked about, he can't identify, even though he was face to face with him and apparently smoking crack with him. So just to give y'all that little extra information.
So Paul, we've got a witness whose timeline might be false or just misremembered.
Yeah.
But what about the time of death in terms of the medical examiner?
Right. Well, you know, the observation the medical examiner is making on Candance's body is showing, you know, a moderate amount of decompositional changes. And, you know, based on how he's describing what he is seeing, you know, she has likely been dead for a couple of days. And this is, it's so variable, but I'm taking a look at where this is happening in Texas in July. You know, it's likely hot out. The house does not look like it's probably a house that has the air conditioning running 24/7. So she's probably being subjected to a fair amount of heat, which is going to speed up the decomposition. But I agree, based on his observation or the medical examiner's observations, that she likely had been dead since the last day that she was seen, which was on the 9th. Now, this particular witness, you know, of course, he's at this house. He's possibly smoking crack or doing a variety of drugs. This, as Paulie was indicating, is potentially going to screw up his memory of things. And this is also just understanding sort of the culture within this type of environment. Even though he's inside this house, I mean, obviously it's suspicious if he's there and Candace is dead inside that house. Why is he still in there? You know, is tends to suggest that he's a killer, and he absolutely would have to be looked at as being the killer. However, and you know, those in law enforcement who have worked to these types of areas would absolutely understand what I'm about to say. This guy doesn't care about that dead body in that house. He's in that house to get high. He is just shrugging at that dead body. He doesn't care about the smell. He is just in there to get high. And this is something that he may be aware of what happened to Candace. He may have even watched what happened to Candace. And then he stayed inside the house and continued to do the dope. And so even as suspicious as it may sound, it is entirely possible he may be an eyewitness. He may be the killer. Or he may just be somebody who's there and has nothing to do with the case and didn't see the crime and is just there because of the drugs.
So currently, Terry is waiting to hear the results of the new testing that is being done on the rape kit and other items from the crime scene. But she told us about the disheartening impression she had from her meeting with the DA.
The last statement, I'll leave you with this. The last statement the DA, the assistant DA said to me, and you can take this, I'll tell you what I thought after she said this. My husband and I looked at each other and we went, oh, shit. She said, don't you worry, mama. When all the DNA gets returned from the labs, you'll know what we did, everything we could do to solve your daughter's case.
What does that mean?
To me, it means it doesn't matter what DNA they get back. This case is never going to be indicted.
So that's the, you know, no matter what DNA they get back, this case is not going to go anywhere. That's basically what they're telling her. What does she do next? I mean, she reached out to us, and thank you for the law enforcement officer who pointed her, towards us, but you know, we're doing this to get loud. We're making phone calls. What else can she do here?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, she is having discussions with the DA. You know, typically the DA is making decisions about whether a case is chargeable, meaning that the investigating agency has identified somebody and has presented the case to the DA. Now, sometimes the DA's office does get involved during the investigation as sort of a legal advisor. However, I'm kind of wondering about, okay, what is going on that this DA is indicating that no matter what the DNA says, we're not necessarily going to be able to move forward. Do they have somebody that they're consulting with that is able to maybe render an opinion that the DNA that they've recovered is from the offender? Or are they thinking because of this particular crime scene location, because of the victimology, that the DNA is just going to get negated by the defense by throwing out all sorts of different strategies to confuse the jury? So at this point, I think, you know, it really is trying to continue to press the investigating agency to continue to build the case to a point to where now a prosecutor can take a look at the evidence and say, yes, I can charge this person with the crime, and I feel confident that I can win a conviction. And this could be through forensic testing. This could be interviewing more witnesses. This could be going and interviewing more suspects, like maybe Razor. You know, so there's so much that the investigating agency can do to help bolster a case. The investigating agency and the DA's office, even though they are on sort of the same team, they're part of the people, but they have two different missions. And so just because the DA's office at this point in time doesn't feel that the case is something that can be prosecuted doesn't mean that the investigating agency stops. And so that's where Terry can continue to press. The family can continue to press. Murder Squad can continue to press the investigating agency to continue to build this case through a variety of methods until they get to a point to where now the DA is confident that they have the right person and that they can secure a conviction.
Yeah. And, you know, all of this is happening in Killeen. And the last time you might have heard this in the context of a crime was the Vanessa Guillen case, which we had talked about on the show before. Now, there's a good website I'd like to direct everybody to called Murdered in Killeen, and it lists really all of the crimes that are going on there and the connection between the military base there, Fort Hood, and the crimes that are committed within that area is something that cannot be avoided. This is an area that is, it just keeps getting, it seems like it just keeps getting worse. And this website, I implore you to take a look at it and look at some of the other cases that we've been talking about there, because there's a lot of stuff that's going on. And the Murdered in Killeen website is done by her parents, by Candance's parents, but they've taken the opportunity, to get loud for, hey, not only for their daughter, but for all of the victims that are there. And I would imagine that, you know, doing that kind of thing is the one of the ways that they're going to be able to push them towards some conclusion. And you know what, if they need a megaphone, we're here for them to amplify that message.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So that brings us to our weekly assignment. Murder Squad, we need to help Terry get loud, and we also need to report the correct information. Now, 36-year-old Candance Boley was last confirmed to have been seen on July 9th, 2011. A friend discovered her body on the evening of July 11th inside her home, inside the bedroom of Palmer Avenue house. She had been beaten and strangled, and the cause of death was blunt force trauma. If you have any information about this crime, please contact us. And we are also going to stay on this police department to make sure that this rape kit is processed, A, and then B, is it run through CODIS? And then if they don't get a hit in CODIS, are they going to do forensic genealogy?
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that I want to point out is, you know, I just recently was in touch with Othram, you know, a friend of mm-hmm. our podcast, and talking to Dr. Middleman, who's running that operation. And, you know, they just recently solved a case out in Las Vegas. And he gave me some of the, you know, the background on that case and the evidence they were working with. And he was working with sexual assault evidence down at the level of 120 picograms. And a picogram is 1/1,000,000,000th of a gram. This is minute. This is incredible sensitivity. So in a case like Candance's, with traditional forensic testing, they may not succeed. But there's now technologies out there that potentially could succeed. And so this is where I would implore the investigating agency, you know, if the current thrust of forensic testing is not successful, don't stop, because there's another step that can be taken.
Absolutely. So that takes us to the rules of don't name names in public, be nice to each other, don't dox each other. And now we get to the weekly distraction. I've been reading the novelization of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino, which is really, really good. And it's a, you know, it tells the story, and, you know, this used to be a big thing. You would be able to see a movie and then read the book. And it's not necessarily about a book that was a book and then 10 years later it was made into a movie. This is like, they wrote a book about the movie, and then they would be able to fill in, you know, different parts of it and, you know, a little bit of backstory here or there. But every movie in the 70s had a novelization. And I was watching an interview with Tarantino, and he was even saying things like the movie Meatballs actually has a novelization. So he actually went through, you know, he's just like, I want to flesh out this world that he had created even more. And he created this novelization of it. And it's really, really good. And he also, you're reading it, and then you're writing down all of these movies that he's mentioning and all of these stars of Hollywood of like the late 50s, early 60s that you're like, oh, you know what? I should watch that movie because he's referencing it. And you're seeing how that colored not only, you know, Tarantino's life, but also colored, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So yeah, that's what I've been distracted with.
Yeah. And when you say novelization, is this something where it's a fictional account, but it's based on the actual making of the movie? Or is this?
No. It's not the making of the movie. It's the movie itself. They're just telling the same story as the movie is, pretty much.
Oh, but converting it into a book.
But converting it into a book, but it's different. He's done it different. Sometimes you're hearing the story through a character's eyes that you had before. You actually get a little bit more empathy for some of the characters that are considered villains in the book and things, but it's good. So
yeah. Yep.
So that's what's been distracting me. So nice job, Quentin. Quentin's only got one more movie in him. That's what he says.
Really? Okay.
Yes. He said one movie and then he's done, but he's doing TV and he's going to do it, but he said 10 movies and he's out.
Okay. Well, good for him. He's decided this is it.
Yes, right. He does not want to go downhill. So yeah. Good for him. Paul, what's been distracting you this week?
Well, you know, I hate to end this with something that's a bit of a downer. Recently my father, who is a listener of the show, suffered a stroke. So jeez. I've been very distracted by that. Fortunately, you know, he is recovering. He's improving. He's got a long road ahead of him. It's something that I just want the listeners, you know, keep his health in their best interests. And hopefully, you know, he gets most of his faculties back, his abilities, and he's a very active gentleman. And hopefully he's out there walking around Diamond Head again someday.
All right. Well, yes, all of our best to him, and we'll definitely be thinking about him. Okay, so everyone, thank you so much. Please, if you're a new listener or an old listener, give us a review on the old podcast, Apple Podcast. It really does help. Follow us on our social media. Go get some merch. We've got some other stuff cooking right now. Until next week, keep digging.
Keep digging. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Pauly Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgariff, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.